From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Kerry says the U.S.-led coalition is on the road to destroying Islamic State. Escape Yazidi women recount their ordeal under Islamic State captivity. An art program to help youth at a Syrian refugee camp in Jordan.
Well, it just, frankly, it gives kids something to do and basically keeps them out of trouble.
And a UN study finds schoolgirls are subject to widespread and regular attacks. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the U.S.-led coalition is on the road to degrading and destroying the Islamic State group. VOA's Victor Beatty reports President Obama's special envoy for the coalition, retired Marine General John Allen, says he expects a major Iraqi-led counteroffensive against the IS group in coming weeks.
Kerry described to U.S. television viewers Sunday a coalition that is more committed than ever, particularly in the aftermath of the execution by burning of a Jordanian pilot seen on a video released last week.
The resounding reaffirmations of commitment throughout the Arab world have been heartening and strong. I mean, here's what's happened. 22% of the populated areas that they held have been taken back already. And that's without launching what we would call a major offensive. It's with the efforts of the Iraqi army as it's being retrained and standing up again to reclaim some territory as they begin to probe. We have taken out a significant proportion of the top leadership of ISIS. Their command and control facilities have been attacked, interrupting their command and control. They no longer can communicate the way they were as openly. They no longer travel in convoys the way they were as openly, or where they do, they're at great risk.
Kerry acknowledges a lot remains to be done, and the effort to degrade and destroy the IS group is a long-term project. He also says Iraq's military is not ready to move yet against IS, and it would be a great mistake strategically for them to move before they are ready. Allen says there will be a major Iraqi-led ground offensive in coming weeks. Speaking to Jordan's Petra news agency, Allen says Iraqi forces, being advised by coalition partners, have retaken the Mosul Dam. He says the IS group has been denied key supply routes to Mosul, as well as the Rabia crossing into Syria. The U.S. envoy says Amirli in northern Iraq, once besieged by IS, has now been relieved, while the Haditha Dam on the Euphrates River is no longer threatened. Allen says members of the coalition, including advisers from Australia, New Zealand, Spain, Portugal, Belgium, the Netherlands, Denmark, Germany, France, and Italy, are training Iraqi troops in four camps in preparation for the counteroffensive. He says when the Iraqis go on the offensive, they will be backed by major coalition firepower. The envoy, who also appeared Sunday on U.S. television, says the execution of the Jordanian pilot backfired on IS and has galvanized and unified the Arab members of the coalition.
It's a very important moment for our Arab allies within the coalition, and I think more broadly within the coalition, it'll be one of those moments that creates additional unity.
Allen warns, however, the IS group is at an entirely different level than Al-Qaeda was. He says they are more organized, have better command and control capabilities, and have a better situational awareness of a broader battle space across the entire region. Jordan's media minister, Mohammed El-Momani, told U.S. television viewers the coalition partners are not yet speaking about putting troops on the ground in Iraq or Syria.
Having said that, this is a war, and His Majesty at some point described it as a third world war. So if circumstances change, then we will discuss it at that point. But at this point of time, I think no one is talking about boots on the ground. The talk is about helping the Iraqi military, the Kurdish armed forces, and the Syrian forces, opposition moderate forces, to help fight terrorism.
The Jordanian officials, his airstrikes over the past 3 days have destroyed 20% of IS targets. He says the death of the country's pilot created a wave of anger across the Arab and Muslim world. He says people now are convinced more than ever that terrorism and extremism must be defeated. The chairman of the U.S. House Homeland Security Committee, Congressman Michael McCaul, says U.S.-led airstrikes have been limited and are aimed only at containing, not destroying, the IS group, which he says poses a security threat to the U.S. homeland.
We have 50,000 ISIS strong and growing. There are about 15,000 to 20,000, it's gone up to 20,000, foreign fighters, 5,000 with Western passports. We've had hundreds of Americans that have traveled to fight in the region, and some of those have returned. So we talk about barbarians at the gate. We need to keep them out of the gate, and we need to monitor those who've gotten through the gate. This is a serious homeland security issue.
Referring to last month's attacks in Paris on the offices of the Charlie Hebdo satirical magazine and a kosher grocery that left 20 people dead, McCall says he doesn't want to see what happened in France occur in the United States. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
When militants of the Islamic State seized parts of northern Iraq 6 months ago, one of the areas hardest hit was that of the Yazidis, an ethnic religious minority living around Sinjar. Militants reportedly killed thousands of men and took the women and children captive. A few of the young women eventually escaped. They recounted their ordeal to VOA's Scott Bobb in Badra, 40 kilometers north of Mosul.
Badra camp in northern Iraq, home to 15,000 displaced Yazidis. Thousands of others are being held captive by Islamic State militants known here as Daesh. 18-year-old Soha Mohammed escaped after 6 months' captivity. She agreed to talk if her face and real name were not revealed. She says IS invaded her village in August and took away all the men.
They separated seven of us girls by force from our mothers and took us to a house. The food was not good. After a month, two Daesh guys came, and they chose some of us and took us to a house in Mosul.
Soham endured repeated rapes and beatings until a month ago when she managed to escape. She says she ran all night until she found a family to take her in. They eventually contacted her uncle, who rescued her. IS fighters killed about 1,700 people in the village of Kocho. More than 100 young women were separated and taken to a house in Raqqa, northern Syria, says 22-year-old Sara Hussein. The militants showed up that night.
Each fighter brought a girl for himself. They came to buy and sell us and convert us to Islam. They raped us and didn't give us food. No one was spared. If one resisted, they would hit all of us, breaking our hands and our heads. We couldn't do anything. Sometimes three of them would violate one girl.
Worse, she says, is what is happening to the younger children.
We escaped, but we are not happy because our families are not here. All our close families are with Daesh. They brainwashed the small kids and gave them injections. All these kids in the future will do the same things to us.
Hussein is angry at the response of the international community, which she says has been too little and too late.
All the major countries are attacking them. America, Saudi Arabia, Australia, France. But they don't care about us. They just care about Iraqi oil. If they want to help us, they would free our kidnapped people.
Hussein escaped in November. She says she wants to testify to the International Court of Justice about what was done to her and her people. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Badra, northern Iraq.
International Relief and Development at its headquarters in suburban Washington is displaying paintings produced by young Syrian refugees living in the Zatri camp in Jordan. IRD is joining the UNHCR and other aid groups to help young men and women learn art skills to make murals and other work for beautification of the camps and for sale. Jim Griffin is IRD Director of Health and spoke with us about the program.
I think the thing that is most striking when you walk through Zatri, there are probably 100,000 refugees living there, is just an inordinate number of young kids. They range, obviously, in age from 5, but you've got a lot of teenagers walking around, and they don't really have anything to do. You know, they go to school. The schools are very packed, so they go to school. They go in shifts, so they're only in school a couple hours a day. And so what we're doing is we've actually, under a grant from UNHCR, what we've established are these what are called basically community centers. And Zatri is divided into 12 districts, and we're trying to put one in each of the districts right at the moment. We haven't gotten to that point yet, but these are kind of, you know, what I would call in the days of community organizing in New York City, where I used to work, these are like community drop-in centers. Mainly youth, but women are involved as well. We do things like we've set up libraries for people. And so they have access to reading material. You know, some of it's like newspapers, novels, you know, all sorts of things, religious texts, things like that. We do Taekwondo for, you know, kids to be active. We do pottery for the women. But this art program is just, you know, providing kids with art supplies so they can sit down and you know, just you know, put some thoughts down on paper.
What do you hope to accomplish by setting up these centers?
Well, it just, frankly, it gives kids something to do and basically keeps them out of trouble. You know, I'd like to profess to a deep-rooted kind of, you know, clinical intervention, but that's really not what it is. It's really just to give kids something to do, you know, give them a, you know, and what had happened was they started creating, some of them create some incredibly good stuff. Women do some really interesting pottery that we try and sell on the local market that gives them access to some income. And it's the same thing with these artists. You know, I looked at some of this and I said, it's really good. We need to figure out how to, you know, how to try and sell some of it so they can have some access to some income of their own.
So you have some of these pieces of art in your office there. Could you describe a couple of your favorite ones?
I'll tell you, I think some of the ones for me are the ones that really reflect a much more personal story. Unfortunately, a lot of these kids have seen some very bad stuff, and I think some of it is, a father holding, you know, preparing his son for an Islamic burial, you know, and it's just, it brings home the fact that, you know, this is a lot of the people who live in Zaatari, a lot of these refugees have seen some very horrible things, as well as some of these kids, you know, and I think, you know, for me, it's a lot about, you know, kind of sad faces, and they range from being, you know, kind of more of your black and white macabre to very colorful, almost psychedelic kind of writing and drawing. So it's very interesting.
So this is a kind of therapeutic for the kids, too. Have they said anything about the art program?
Oh, they talk a lot about it. They talk a lot about it. You know, part of it is, you know, talking through with these kids some of the things that they see. I mean, I'll be very honest with you. One of the things that, you know, we've been talking about, every time I go to Jordan, which is fairly frequently, I go up to Zaatari. And, you know, a year ago, I mean, you would just see these kids around it, and I mean, a lot of them are boys, and, you know, boys play rough. I know that, but you'd see a lot of anger in these kids, you know. And the Taekwondo program has been extremely helpful in helping them channel some of that, as is the art program. And we hire a lot of kids to, you know, do artisan-type work, carpentry and things like that to help us. We do a lot of maintenance work on behalf of UNHCR there.
Jim Griffin, International Relief and Development Director of Health, speaking with us from the IRD headquarters in Arlington, Virginia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
A new study finds millions of girls in at least 70 countries are subjected to widespread attacks that are occurring with increasing regularity to prevent them from receiving an education. The report by the United Nations Human Rights Office finds schools and infrastructure in 24 of these countries also are used for military purposes. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
While celebrating the achievements of the past two decades in ensuring that millions of girls around the world have access to education, the study also highlights the current grim state of girls' education. UN statistics show about 65 million children do not attend school, particularly in countries of sub-Saharan Africa, Oceania, and West Asia. The report documents many cases between 2009 and 2014 of physical attacks against girls, parents, and teachers advocating for gender equality in education. Some of the attacks cited have made headlines and shocked people by their cruelty. These include the killing in December 2014 of more than 100 children by the Taliban at an army school in Pakistan, the abduction of nearly 300 schoolgirls by Boko Haram in Nigeria in April 2014, and the 2012 shooting of the young Nobel Peace Laureate Malala Yousafzai by members of the Taliban in Pakistan. The chief of the Women's Human Rights and Gender Section at the UN Human Rights Office, Veronica Birga, says many other alarming attacks against girls never make the headlines. For instance, she cites cases of acid attacks and poisoning by the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan.
A number of girls were abducted from a Christian school in India and raped in 2013. In Somalia, girls have been forcibly removed from school to become so-called wives of Al-Shabaab fighters. And in countries such as Mali, Sudan, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, very strict dress codes have been imposed through the use of violence, including sexual violence, on schoolgirls.
The report notes attacks on girls do not take place only in countries in conflict. They also occur in situations of high criminality or political instability, which is the case in a number of countries of Central America. It says girls are attacked by those who are opposed to their education as a means of social change. They believe education is wasted on girls whose role is to remain at home. It says the common cause of all these attacks is discrimination. Birga says girls who are prevented from going to school are extremely vulnerable to exploitation and abuse.
And since they're more exposed to child and forced marriages, they're more exposed to trafficking, they're more exposed to worst forms of child labor. And more in general, a girl that's not educated will face, consequences throughout her life. A girl or a woman who's not educated is less likely to be aware of her rights and less likely to be able to claim them.
The report urges governments to make the perpetrators of attacks against schoolgirls, their parents, and teachers accountable for their actions. It says the message that violence against girls is acceptable is reinforced when attacks are met with impunity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Despite recent progress in the fight against Ebola, a health official in Guinea says the number of people who have fallen ill with the deadly virus has doubled in the past week. About two dozen previously unreported cases have been discovered, taking the total number of new cases to 53, as officials reach rural communities where they had been denied entry. The World Health Organization says the unaddressed needs of children, pregnant women, and Ebola survivors need to be met in Guinea and the other two hard-hit West African nations, Sierra Leone and Liberia. WHO technical advisor Dr. Margaret Harris says a child's health could change quickly and requires monitoring.
Children deteriorate much more rapidly, very quickly. You can have a child that looks all right, especially a neonate, that looks all right 1 minute and then is desperately ill the next minute. So managing a child under 1 year is always really an intensive care sort of situation without necessarily having lots of needles, but in nursing terms it's very much an intensive care situation, and this simply wasn't available, hasn't been available in the Ebola treatment units to date.
According to WHO figures, 21% of pregnant women affected with Ebola have survived. But issues remain regarding the delivery of babies, including fluids that could endanger health workers.
How to make sure that you can deliver a woman safely? What do you do when a woman has recovered from Ebola but is still carrying a baby? And we know that the delivery of that baby will be a very risky time for those who deliver the baby. How do you make sure you can keep in touch with the woman and ensure that she delivers safely in a place where you've got good infection prevention control? All the people are in their personal protective equipment.
Dr. Harris says Ebola survivors have to be monitored more closely and for an extended period of time for what she calls post-Ebola syndrome symptoms.
You've recovered from a dreadful disease, and then you discover that nobody wants you to live in your community, nobody wants you to work where you worked, nobody wants to even sell you food because they're afraid of you. So unpicking the psychological problems is not an easy task, but it's essential that this group of people are provided with very good medical and psychological supportive care, and this is something that needs to be done long term.
Dr. Harris says this is the largest group of survivors of Ebola on record, and their monitoring will be beneficial in light of future outbreaks. Some good news from the UN Children's Fund. UNICEF reports that nearly all children who lost parents to Ebola are being cared for by their local communities. The agency estimates some 16,000 children lost at least one parent to the disease, but less than 3% have been placed outside family or community care. British singer-songwriter Sam Smith took up the top honors at the music industry's Grammy Awards in Los Angeles, where he earned 4 awards, including Best New Artist. Mike O'Sullivan reports from backstage at the Grammys. The musician Beck was a surprise winner of the Key Award of Album of the Year.
It was no surprise when Sam Smith, the soulful 22-year-old English singer, was named Best New Artist. Smith also won Grammys for Best Pop Vocal Album for In the Lonely Hour and Song and Record of the Year for the track Stay With Me.
Oh, won't you stay with me? 'Cause you're all I need. This ain't love. But darling, stay with me.
Smith said that when he started his career, he was desperate to get his music heard.
I tried to lose weight and I was making awful music. And it was only until I started to be myself that the music started to flow and people started to listen. So thank you, guys.
Backstage, as he struggled to hold his 4 Grammy statuettes, he said he grew up obsessed with celebrity culture and that being at the Grammys is a thrill.
And when you start to meet everyone, you start to realize they are just humans, you know, and they're just very talented humans, and it's an honor to be sitting with people like that.
A surprised rock musician Beck walked on stage reluctantly to accept the Grammy for Album of the Year for Morning Phase. He also won the award for Best Rock Album. Country musician Dwight Yoakam, speaking backstage about Beck's triumph, had praise for the musician, who has explored genres from alternative rock to hip-hop. The two collaborated on a 2012 album.
He really embodies the spirit of awe about music and exploration in music. He has a reverence for music, and in that reverence, he's willing to be irreverent at times.
Beyonce earned 3 Grammys, including Best Rhythm and Blues Song and Best R&B Performance with her husband Jay-Z for Drunk in Love.
Wow, thank you guys so much. This is such an honor. I'd like to thank God. This has been such an incredible year. I love y'all.
Rapper Pharrell Williams also earned 3 awards, including for Best Pop Solo Performance for the song Happy.
Because I'm clap along if you feel like a room without a roof.
Country singer Roseanne Cash also earned 3 Grammys. Miranda Lambert earned the Grammy for Best Country Album for Platinum. Backstage, she said the win shows that people are paying attention to her music.
It's moving people. That's why we make music, to move people. So this makes all that make sense.
President Barack Obama appeared in a public service announcement during the broadcast, urging an end to domestic violence, and a survivor of violence offered her testimonial. The evening featured more than 35 performers, many in groups that crossed barriers of age, style, and genre, including a duet by 88-year-old Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga. The pair won a Grammy for Best Traditional Pop Vocal Album for their joint recording, Cheek to Cheek. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you know what else you can do there? Well, you can re-listen to this show or any of the other international editions, go to our website, go to the Programs tab, and scroll on down to International Edition and listen to your heart's content. Thanks a lot. I'm Susan Yaffe in Washington.